This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jannat Jalil, and in the early hours of Monday, the 27th of March, these are our main stories. Tens of thousands of Israelis take to the streets again after the defense minister is sacked by Benjamin Netanyahu for opposing his judicial overhaul. NATO allies voice their concerns over Russia's plans to station tactical nuclear weapons in Belarus. At least 29 people have drowned in the latest migrant boat sinkings off the coast of Tunisia. Also in this podcast, we look back on the life of the founder of one of the world's biggest dumpling empires. As we record this podcast, the political crisis in Israel is intensifying even further. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has sacked the Defence Minister, Yoav Gallant, after he broke ranks and urged the government to ditch its highly controversial plans to reform the judicial system. Tens of thousands of Israelis have again taken to the streets to protest, with reports that barriers near Mr. Netanyahu's home in Jerusalem had been breached. Our correspondent there, Anna Foster, described the scene.
Well, what you can hear probably tells you a lot about what I can see right now. We're in central Jerusalem. This protest started outside the home of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and it's now broken away, and they're heading towards the Knesset, the Israeli Parliament, because, of course, this is all about legislation and legislation that these protesters are trying to stop. The problem is police are out, of course, soldiers are out as well. I've just seen one with his baton drawn, and in fact a water cannon has just come flying down this street, drenching this particular group of protesters as it went. What they're doing now is climbing through some undergrowth because all of these main roads are closed. They are determined to get to the parliament and to make their feelings felt. And this is just Jerusalem. These protests are happening across the country. There are tens of thousands of people out in central Tel Aviv blocking the Eilon Highway. We're hearing about protests right across the country tonight in response to the sacking of Yoav Gallant, Israel's defense minister.
Yeah, you mentioned that sacking of Yoav Gallant. Just to explain how it all came to this, his departure, and perhaps most important, might other members of this government leave with him?
Well, that's a very good question. The key thing is that he is a member of Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party, and that's why this is particularly galling for Mr. Netanyahu, because he needs to try and hold this coalition together if he wants to remain in power and if he wants to push this legislation through, which is something that his far-right coalition co-members are very, very much pushing for. Now, Yoav Gallant was originally going to make a statement. I should just say, by the way, while I'm talking to you, we're climbing through this undergrowth. If you're wondering why I sound a little bit unsteady, that is why, because we're sticking with this protest as they head the Knesset. Yoav Gallant was originally going to make a statement on Thursday evening, but he had a meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu, who managed to persuade him not to go public. But then last night he did. He made a televised statement and he called for this legislation to be paused. And then, of course, 24 hours later, we see this sacking, and a really dangerous moment for this country, which has seen protests like this for 12 weeks now, and for Benjamin Netanyahu, if he wants to try and keep a lid on what is happening here now.
Yeah, Mr. Netanyahu seems to have been able to weather all sorts of political storms throughout his career. Could this really be the greatest challenge? Is his government at risk now?
I think what you're seeing here is a prime minister who treasures power, as so many do. And of course, remember that he has had now a period where he wasn't leading this country. He came back into power in November of last year at the most recent election. And in order to do that, he had to form this coalition with some of the most far-right elements of Israeli politics. Now, he is desperate to try and keep his job. That is why he is trying so hard to push this legislation through, to hold this coalition together, because that is what his future as prime minister really depends on.
Anna Foster in Jerusalem, speaking there to Peter Goffin. Since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine last year, fears that Moscow might use a nuclear weapon have risen. On Saturday, those fears were heightened by President Putin's announcement that Russia was planning to station tactical nuclear weapons in Belarus. That's provoked strong condemnation by NATO allies of what they call the Kremlin's dangerous and irresponsible nuclear rhetoric. They reject Mr. Putin's claim that what he's planning is no different to the US basing some of its nuclear weapons in European countries. Ukraine said the move would make Belarus a nuclear hostage. Yuri Sak is an advisor to Ukraine's Ministry of Defense.
We have been living with the hypothetical threat of the possible nuclear strike, you know, from day one of the large-scale invasion. And we have seen how Russia is employing these tactics of nuclear blackmail, you know, around the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in particular, now this. So nobody can rule out everything, okay? We don't have a crystal ball.
Our correspondent in Kyiv, Hugo Bishega, told us more about the reaction to President Putin's latest announcement.
I think what we've seen since the start of the invasion is that President Putin, senior Russian officials have frequently talked about nuclear weapons and have even raised the possibility of nuclear weapons being used in this conflict. And they know that every time they do it, those remarks spark concern in some countries, reaction from some countries. And this is exactly what we're seeing here today. So NATO has reacted, saying that this Russian rhetoric was irresponsible. It said it was following the situation, but that it hadn't seen any changes in Russia's nuclear posture. There's been some reaction here in Kyiv as well. The foreign minister said Russia was using nuclear weapons as a tool of threats and intimidation, and called for an emergency session of the UN Security Council. And there's been also some reaction from Washington, the US obviously being the key ally of the Ukrainians in this war. And I think perhaps there was an attempt to downplay concerns that this could suggest that Russia could be planning to use tactical nuclear weapons. And a senior US official said there were no signs that Russia was preparing to do so.
And Russia is dismissing the concerns of NATO, saying actually what it's proposing to do is no different from the US basing some of its nuclear arsenal in the territory of European allies. But NATO says that's misleading.
Yeah, well, President Putin is saying that there's nothing unusual in this statement. And again, he said that the US has long deployed its own nuclear weapons in European countries. And I mean, Russia and Belarus have, you know, been talking about the transfer of nuclear weapons for quite some time. President Putin is saying that this does not violate the nuclear non-proliferation deals that Russia has signed. But again, the Ukrainians are saying that this is simply not true. We heard from a senior security official here saying that, you know, Moscow has taken Belarus as a nuclear hostage following this announcement. We don't know when those weapons will be transferred. I think it's important to say. The president said that, you know, the construction of a facility will be finished by July the 1st, but he hasn't said when those weapons will be sent to Belarus.
So you've got voices in Ukraine saying that Belarus is being taken a nuclear hostage. What is Belarus itself saying?
That's very interesting, because we haven't heard from the Belarusian leader, Alexander Lukashenko. He is obviously a key ally of President Putin. Belarus has been used as a base for Russian forces. Remember, back in the early days of the war, Russian forces invaded Ukraine from Belarus. And I think what the Ukrainians are saying is that, again, this decision could destabilize Belarus and deprive Belarus of its sovereignty. And I think one of the main opposition leaders in Belarus is saying that, well, this announcement means that Belarus has become just another Russian region.
Hugo Bishega. Let's stay in Ukraine, where for months Russia has thrown its forces into capturing the city of Bakhmut. Despite thousands of dead on both sides, which has left the city in ruins, the Ukrainians are managing to hold on to Bakhmut, denying Moscow a much-needed victory, even as it runs short of military equipment to maintain the assault. The International Red Cross estimates that some 2,000 civilians are still in the city despite the fierce fighting, with thousands more living nearby in villages and towns where they've sought refuge. Achille Desprez of the International Red Cross has recently visited the area.
We are able to deliver convoys of humanitarian assistance to localities in the immediate vicinity of Bakhmut. We are delivering humanitarian aid to Chasivyar, that's some 20 kilometers outside of Bakhmut, and also to Konstantinivka, which is 40 kilometers outside of Bakhmut. The situation inside the city, because of the hostilities that are going on, is just too dangerous. It's an active zone of combat. Therefore, we are not going into the city, but we are working closely with the municipalities that are right outside, and we are providing them humanitarian assistance in the form of food or water or hygiene items for the people that have been displaced from Bakhmut, because a lot of the people from Bakhmut or from localities right outside of it have already evacuated. The few thousands that remain are typically the most vulnerable people, including elderly, including low mobility people or people with disabilities. So we really have to serve their humanitarian needs where they are. Many buildings, if not all buildings, are destroyed. Civilians that are remaining spend most of their time in shelter in underground areas because of the intensity of military hostilities going on. And they're lacking basically the essentials. We know that the access to drinking water is a huge issue. Actually, we have brought 6,000 liters of drinking water to a locality right outside Bakhmut. We know that they're lacking also food. We know that they're lacking hygiene items. So they're living in very, very dire humanitarian conditions. And just being even in localities right outside of it, we hear constant explosions, exchange of artillery. So these are conditions that are very difficult. And a resident of a locality right outside of Bakhmut who I spoke to told me, we are not living here in these conditions. We're just surviving.
Achille Desprez of the Red Cross. Rescue workers in the United States are continuing their search for survivors after a devastating tornado in Mississippi killed more than 25 people and left dozens more injured. The storm carved a path of destruction through the Mississippi Delta, one of the poorest regions of the U.S., flattening not just houses but whole neighborhoods. The governor of Mississippi, Tate Reeves, paid tribute to those involved in the aid effort.
What we've seen over the last 36 hours in Mississippi, on the one hand, has been heartbreaking to see the loss and devastation of these communities, and on the other hand, has been inspiring and gives me great reason for optimism, and quite frankly, makes me damn proud to be a Mississippian, because Mississippians have done what Mississippians do. In times of tragedy, in times of crisis, they stand up and they show up.
Sophie Long sent this report from one of the hardest hit areas, the town of Rolling Fork in the Mississippi Delta.
We got a new scan coming in here as we speak. Oh, man. Like, north side of Amory, this is coming in. Dear Jesus, please help them. Amen.
That was a television weather forecaster in the moments before the tornado struck. But many didn't get any warning of what was to come. Shantaya Howard was in one of the few houses that's damaged but still standing.
It was just a regular Friday night, you know, friends at the house, you know, over. We playing with the kids and the lights flickered out and everyone is in separate rooms. And when the wind had came through and actually pulled down the roof and pulled down the insulation and broke the windows, the only thing we could do was just run for cover in the bathroom. So we were basically holding each other and praying for everyone's safety.
There are so many homes here in Rolling Fork that have been completely leveled to the ground. You can see washing machines that have been tossed from one property to another. There are cars that started off on one side of the street here and they're hundreds of meters away now. Francisco McKnight told me the only warning he had was the terrifying sound of the wind. It's a noise he says will haunt him forever.
You were in the front room.
There's a front door right there.
Yeah.
So I was on the couch first.
And then you heard the sound coming.
Yep. So I went to the door and peeked out the door and seen how the trees was blowing and ran in the bathroom, closed the door and jumped in the tub.
So you were in that bathtub?
Yep.
And that's basically the only part of your house that could have protected you?
Yep. And that part right there. So it's like a blessing, huh? But I made it through there, but it was scary.
There is some long-term resentment here. Mississippi is the poorest state in America. And some feel forgotten by leaders in the nation's capital. Here's Shantaya again.
Excuse my language. Damn, you forgot about us? Just because we are the last in everything, you forgot about us? That's not right. That is very heart-wrenching, other than we lost everything, and we feel that we don't have support from the superior people also.
President Biden has described what's happened here as heartbreaking and said he and the First Lady are praying for those who've lost loved ones. But people here are asking for more than prayers and emergency relief. They want long-term support.
Sophie Long. Still to come,
quickly, word spread around about these dumplings and the business just took off from there.
The rags-to-riches life story of the man who founded a dumpling empire. Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Recent days have seen a string of shipwrecks as people try to get to Italy from Tunisia. In the latest fatal crossings, at least 29 people drowned after at least two boats sank within hours of each other. Many of those who've died are sub-Saharan Africans who've been desperately trying to leave Tunisia after the president, Kais Saied, whipped up racist anger against them by accusing them of causing a crime wave. Journalist Alicia Volkman is in the Tunisian capital, Tunis.
There's a very established trafficking route. It's highly exploitative. People save up thousands of dinars to cross. A lot of the people who were evicted in the recent racial violence, you know, they reported that as well as being evicted, they had their savings taken away from them. So they had been working clandestinely to earn the money to pay for the crossing. And particularly now, you know, in the spring weather, you know, with the gales and the choppy sea, it's a very dangerous time to cross. But people are doing it because they no longer feel safe in Tunisia, particularly the sub-Saharan population, who suffered from this sort of wave of violence that erupted in late February.
You talk about racial violence. So there does seem to be, does there, some concerted campaign against sub-Saharan migrants in Tunisia? And is that linked to remarks made by the president?
Very much so, very much so. I mean, the series of events was such that it started with the sort of annual mass roundups by police. They tend to sort of pick on black people to see if they have what's a carte de séjour, which is a residency permit. And it's a very negative cycle because people apply, particularly students, they apply in September for their residency permit and the administration doesn't give the permit. So January, February, there are these mass arrests. And this year, same as last year, there are 300 arrests. And then there was this highly publicized transcription of a meeting between the president and his Security Council, where he said that Tunisia needs urgent measures to push back these hordes of migrants and was accusing them of criminality and violence, and very much echoing a narrative that's been building over the last year that's been pushed by the Nationalist Party. Their agenda is to get rid of black people from Tunisia. And then what happened was that he also passed a decree law about the issue of the carte de séjour, imposing higher penalties for people who didn't have one, but also cracking down on people who employed people without carte de séjour in formal employment like cafes and construction.
Alicia Volkman speaking to Julian Marshall. Lebanon has seen crisis after crisis in recent years, its economy going into freefall, the pandemic, and the massive Beirut port explosion 3 years ago. Now it has a new problem to contend with, two time zones. The government has decided to delay putting the clocks forward until the end of Ramadan, putting it out of sync with most of Europe and some parts of the Middle East. It's thought this is to allow Muslims to break their daily fast earlier. But the move is opposed by Christians and some Muslims who say it goes against the spirit of Ramadan. Karine Torbay in Beirut told us more.
It's a total mess. People are completely lost what time to follow, which appointments falls under which time zone or which time reading. Because what we have currently in Lebanon is two different timings for exactly the same moment, which actually you can imagine creates massive, massive confusion. But it isn't only about confusion. It would have been manageable if it was just that for the three coming weeks, because then we'll move back to summertime. It's basically that this has created, a whole kind of sectarian rift. And it seems that it was not just ill-prepared and it seems kind of, impulsive. And it didn't take into consideration all the consequences to such a decision taken at such a short notice. It triggered a lot of reactions, and these reactions seemed to come from Christian entities, TV stations that have, you know, Christian identity. And then the head of the Maronite Church, the biggest church in the country, decided that it will not comply, and it's switching to summertime. So basically, at the moment, everyone in the country has two different times to observe. There has been a lot of confusion in the, at the airport. And just because the decision was taken just 2 days ago, the airport in Beirut sent messages to all the passengers who have any trips, you know, for the next 3 weeks, alerting them to a change of the time. Basically, what they're trying to do is to abide by the Lebanese time when it comes to takeoff time. Well, I say Lebanese time, I'm not sure which one, you know, I'm referring to. I would say the official Lebanese time. But this is really, really chaotic. You've got students in different schools starting at different times tomorrow. You've got, you know, workers at the moment all going about whether we should start at 8 or 9, which time are we following. And every single institution in the country is issuing some sort of clarification about which time zone it is at the moment going by.
Karine Torbay in Beirut. In Colombia, the chief of police has said he and other officers have been using several unusual techniques, including exorcism, to track down some of the country's most wanted criminals. General Henry Sanabria, who is a devout Catholic, was speaking in a newspaper interview. James Reed has more details.
General Sanabria is well known in Colombia for his hardline religious views. But his comments about the use of exorcism by the security forces have come as a surprise. He said the rituals had been used in operations that led to the killing of the notorious drug lord Pablo Escobar, as well as top FARC rebel commanders. The general said exorcism was necessary to overcome the witchcraft he claimed many criminals used to protect themselves. Asked about the remarks, President Gustavo Petro said General Sanabria's religious beliefs had to be respected as long as they didn't interfere with his work. But he would have a word with him.
James Reed. The founder of one of the world's biggest dumpling empires has died. Yang Bingyi opened a small business with his wife in Taiwan, which took off and expanded into the global franchise Din Tai Fung. Its Hong Kong branch even won a Michelin star. The dumplings became so famous that Hollywood star Tom Cruise even tried his hand at making some on a visit to the Taipei branch.
Yep. There we go.
Okay, very good. Very good.
Maybe I can get a job here.
Our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow told us more about Yang Bingyi and how his dumplings conquered the world.
It's one of these rags-to-riches stories. Yang Bingyi was born in Shanxi province, an inland province in China, at a time of civil war across the country. He ended up leaving China and going to Taiwan in 1948, just as the civil war there was at its height. And he got a job in a company selling cooking oil. He then started his own business. When the business started to fail, he then decided with his wife to open a small restaurant selling what became and what's become the signature dish of his restaurants, called Din Tai Fung, the restaurant's name. And these are a little pork dumplings called Xiaolongbao. Exquisite, they're delicious. I've had them myself. And quickly word spread around about these dumplings, and the business just took off from there. And now there are 170 branches, mostly across Southeast Asia, but some as far away as New York and London and Sydney.
And you say you've had them yourself. What was so special about them?
These Xiaolongbao, they've got very thin, delicate skin. Now they're folded, these skins, 18 times, a very precise figure, but that's the restaurant has decided that's the perfect symmetry for these little buns. They're then steamed in bamboo baskets, and they're quite soupy, so when you bite into them, all this kind of juice comes spurting out and, you know, can be quite hot, but they're absolutely delicious.
They do sound quite mouth-watering. I mean, he gets a lot of credit for this. How much credit should go to his wife?
Well, of course, his wife helped with the business and helped run the business. And in fact, it's still a family business now because his eldest son has taken over it. And his eldest son really has has transformed this restaurant into a global brand and expand it across and into many different other countries. The restaurant's also famous for its service. People who go and work there, they're taught how to greet customers, how to smile. There are even reports that the management tell their workers how to brush their teeth so they present the best smile to their customers.
Michael Bristow, and apologies if that report left you feeling hungry. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Eleanor Sly. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.